Welcome to the Admin Happen podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on a help desk, a networking engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Jerry.
Hey, it's not Andy, it's Jerry. Yeah. Andy's out with his son because it's his birthday, and we thought we'd kind of want to get Jerry back on. He wants to come part of the team, so hopefully he'll be on many more episodes. So welcome aboard there, Jerry.
Glad to be here.
So what have you been up to work this week, or any stories to tell or anything interesting?
If anyone follows my Twitter feed, which they probably don't, I did a particularly heroic thing in my eyes of foiling a distributed denial of service attack on a client's server using a clever bit of software, which we might go into later, possibly.
Yeah.
So I was quite happy with that. But I've just been working hard all week, staring at computer screens most of my waking hours. So, yeah. How about you?
Yeah. Busy at work, and so I've had quite a few things I want to talk about tonight. Regarding how did you know that someone was DDoSing your server? Did it just go offline, or does it being...
No, it showed up in the high load average, which is basically a measure of the CPU, how hard it's working.
Yeah.
It came up, web pages saying, I can't remember what the exact error message is, but it's like it's basically you go to the site on the server, or one of the sites on the server, and it says, I can't serve this page for you. So had a look at the server, and then had a look in the logs, like we Linux admins do, and in the server access log, in the error log, it was saying, basically, I can't serve these requests. So I'm running out of resources. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the access log, and I noticed there were a lot of the same sort of accesses from various different IPs. And there's a bit of software called Fail2Ban, and what it does is it actually goes through your log files for you, and you can set it to look for things like that. So if something's making the same request over and over again, you can say, grab the IP that's doing that, and using the internal firewall, block it for a certain amount of time, and that normally does the trick. It certainly did in this case. I mean, now that I sort of describe it like that, it seems like that might have been quite a simple attack, and there might be more complex ones, but I was quite happy.
Yeah, were they like trying to attack SSH, or were they just pinging it kind of thing, or doing some DNS?
Yeah, it was making a certain request for, it's called XML RPC, and doing it, you know, multiple times a second, and doing that is enough to bring down the server. It was a WordPress site, and there's various vulnerabilities in WordPress if you don't keep it updated, and that was probably one of them as well. I would have thought so. You know, once they can hijack your blog, and once they've your WordPress blog, and if you know, they can get further into the server if the server isn't secured properly. So because when you run a web server, it doesn't matter how secure you make it if the web app isn't secure, because that's what you're exposing to the internet. So, yeah. So, cool. Security is quite a big thing.
Okay, we can go to that Fail2Ban thing later on. That'd be quite cool. So, I went to an interesting talk this week. The local Institute of Engineering Technology run these free lectures at my local hotel, and I didn't know about it. One of my colleagues at work said, "Do you want to go?" So I said, "All right then." And it was about these Bloodhound missiles. They were like one of the defences in the Cold War. They were like used from like 1970s or to about 1990s to protect the UK from if we ever something happened in the Cold War. And it was really odd that they're all controlled by these Argos computers. Not Argos, that's in the chain in the store in the UK. But,
yeah.
Yeah, it was really, and it's really interesting that these people, it was basically people retired were kind of were like trying to save them. They had like obviously been, when they were decommissioned from when the MOD finished them, they were trying to like preserve them to let people know about them. And they're like, okay, there's like a bit like I won't say a caravan kind of thing, but like a box what goes with it where the people controlled these missiles from. They had the radar equipment in them. They run all by this Argos computer, but they also they can run it in a demo mode so that you could practice if it, whatever happened, you can practice it. And their people basically fix this so that they can take that schools can go there and they can pretend that they can stopping bombs and stuff. And it's quite interesting that these boards, like, it's apparently they're basically, these Argos computers are very good at controlling IO things out. And apparently some of the UK's infrastructure apparently still runs on these things to control certain things. So very interesting. Apparently there's like a company that still fixes them. And if you've got a board go wrong, they're like $6,000 to fix one of these boards at a time kind of thing. So it's...
Blimey.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember I've seen Bloodhound missiles at... I went to a lot of air shows when I was younger.
Yeah.
And they're quite impressive, aren't they? They're massive things.
They're like about three... In the day, they're like £1 million to buy each, called climbing. We like bought like 180 of them. I don't know. It's ridiculous how much expensive they are. So
tax pounds going to good use. Of it, I suppose. Were they surface to air missiles?
Yes.
They shoot down incoming aeroplanes or incoming
bombers,
missiles,
I think, or incoming bombers or missiles, kind of thing. So in the Cold War days. So
it's
really odd because I didn't really kind of know that kind of thing when you were a kid. I was like growing up that age. You didn't really understand it was all happening when you were a kid. You didn't really know. No one ever really mentioned it, did they? So.
I think I was just old enough to be a bit paranoid about it because I was, you know, the Berlin Wall came down in 89 and I was 13. Right. So I was just about old enough to get really scared about nuclear war. And then kind of the threat receded a bit.
Yeah, I was about 9. It was 89 minutes. I was 9 then. So So that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I was quite surprised that it was free. Good evening out. So I learned quite a bit there.
Excellent. Yeah. Sounds good. Yeah.
A couple of things, and I'll go through my list and what we can go through. So this is a vulnerability that came out this week. MS-14066. This S channel issue. No one actually knows the person who found out about the vulnerability has told Microsoft about it, and then Microsoft have basically come up with a fix. But no one knows kind of how no one in the world knows how to take use of this vulnerability. So like, people are going to start reverse engineering this issue. So it's a bit like, I'd say it's like the same sort of level as what the Heartbleed issue is to the Linux world. It basically means this S-channel thing, like the whole SSL thing inside Windows. It does a lot more than does SSL. Anything securely channels, it does in Linux, in Windows. That's what it uses. It's but the problem you've got is that if you've got a server which is on the internet and you've got SSL, like it's doing websites or something, and you haven't done this patch and you know how to do it, you'd be able to overtake that server. There's nothing, it's not like you just basically send a mail form packets in a certain way to the server and then you can take over the server. So
sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, so you haven't got to have anything running some certain software on the server or anything, or you've got to have something open. Any server's vulnerable, which if you've got one percentage of your website, something like your Exchange server, OWA, IIS, ActiveSync, anything like that needs to be need to get protected. So guys, get your servers patched ASAP.
Does it go through a certain port, or because if you had a web server running, presumably you'd have it running kind of in a DMZ or something like that, so and you wouldn't have any other services on it.
No, but it basically just, if you've got 443 open to the web, it will try and hack it kind of thing. Right. It'll send packets to it. I don't know that much, but if you listen to Security Now this week, it will tell you about it more. So here,
I haven't got round to that yet. I've got to put aside my 2 hours to get up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a good blogger post I'm going to put on in the show notes. It's a guy, he's going about migrating 2003 to 2010. Sorry, 2012, sorry, because 2003 is coming end of life next year. So, you know, XP kind of end of life this year. Mainstream support, 2003 is happening, the same thing's happening next year. So, people need to start thinking about migrating this, whatever they've got, off 2003 to obviously the new server. So this guy's written a blog post on how to migrate, if you've got a file server running 2003 on the server, only doing file server, how to migrate it to 2012. So that's quite an interesting little blog. So people start thinking about what you need to do. If you've got any clients or some of your servers at work are running 2003, you need to think about moving them across, because they're not going to be supported from April next year.
Right. It rings a bell, actually, because my day job, I think I heard them say something about they've got some 2003 servers running, and they've got to obviously get them sorted out. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously quite important, because they have just left them as they are until they absolutely have to do something about it. So.
Yeah, start thinking about it. So another thing is that Runners Radio is another good podcast. I like to it's a Windows, and they have different people on there talking about things. And there's on this one a couple weeks ago, there's one about High Availability Exchange, and it was a really good podcast about telling you all the different levels of how to do High Availability Exchange with DAGs and CAS arrays. And there's a he was going on about that he's releasing this book, Deploying Managing High Ability for Exchange Server 2013, and it's really good. So people when I'm looking at running Exchange should go and have a look at that site. There's also a site there called exchangeserverpro.com, the guy who did the podcast, I can't think what his name is, and he's got, if you sign up for his you go to his website and you sign up, it's free. You basically get a newsletter every week, you get a discount on his new book, and you also get an insider's guide to Exchange. And there's actually videos on there he's done of how to actually install Exchange, and that they're quite good videos to watch if you never installed Exchange before. So that's quite interesting.
Is the high availability stuff built into Windows, or is it kind of third party?
No, it's all built into it. So you've got high ability in Windows, and you've got high ability in Exchange. So high ability in Windows is clustering. So you can do clustered servers and stuff like, so if you've got a SQL server, you can cluster it on top of the Exchange. You can have a clustered Windows file server. So the annoying thing normally you've got to do is you've got to have shared storage for the two. So you've got to have some sort of SAN connected by fiber or SCSI.
For doing that's it. Usually, I think that's usually the case. Do you have like virtual IPs and things as well?
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's getting a lot
similar in Linux world. So.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So go and check that site out. It's quite good. I've been doing a lot with Veeam. I don't know if you heard of this backup product. I don't know if you use it at your day job.
I remember you talking about it in the last podcast. Backing up VMs, is it?
Yeah. So it's really good. Yeah. It's so powerful. How powerful it is. You can restore, the good thing about it, you can do things like I use it to back up my own virtual machines at home, and I haven't got to worry about I've used it to back up my Linux boxes, so I haven't got any scripts or anything. It basically just takes a snapshot of it, and then it takes a snapshot, and then if you take a snapshot of it, it's like if someone pulls the power out of the server. So when you restore the image, it's good. So how it works is that you it works with VMware or Hyper-V. It basically takes an image of the server. So it takes an image of the virtual hard drives and it puts it into its own little format. And you can do things like if you've got 10 machines, if you put it into one backup job, you can do inline duplication. So that obviously, if you've got like 10 Windows machines, it just backs it. It compresses it all and de-dupes it. So obviously your Windows directory, you've got 10 Windows directories at 20 gig a time, and it knows that, oh, I already got that Windows directory, so I'm not going to bother backing that up.
Okay.
So it's really good. And if you want to restore stuff, it's so fast to restore, because you can do a certain thing where, if you want to, you can do a thing called an instant restore, where it actually puts the VM back in directly to the server by whatever storage it's on at the moment. So it's like it's running from your backup device. So because it's not like a tape backup, it's actually a physical backup. So like I was saying before, I've got like 10 terabytes worth of data disks, and it'll run it directly from that. It'll be slower than running on the putting it back into the heart, back into the SAN, but it means you can get your VMs back in and like back up and going in 5 minutes, not having to like restore the whole VM. I mean, getting people glad that they've got the VM back up as soon as possible, rather than having to back it up, having to wait 4 hours for it to back it up, restoring the data back into the SAN, and then having it then powering it up, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. So in what sort of scenario do you need to restore VMs?
Well, two things. So let's say you have a major issue, you get a corruption or something, or in your Windows box or something, or you can do things like you can go into it and you can restore single files or whatever.
Okay.
But say like if you had a major problem like a virus or something, or you just get a system crash, or you put an update on and it corrupts it or whatever.
Right.
Instead of having to just, so you don't, because the old good old days like semantic backup exec, all you would do is you'd have to create a new VM, install Windows, and then put the software back. So then using Veeam, backup exec, you then use that to put the system state back in, and then all the files and everything. Whereas the Veeam, you didn't do anything, because it's a copy of the virtual hard drive. So you just boot that virtual hard drive up.
Yeah. Now, it's a strange thing with my clients. They're often relying on these sort of VM backups, I sort of look at their servers, even if they're VMs, as servers. So if I'm backing up websites, I'll sort of go into the server and back up the files that make up the website and the database.
Yes.
And that allows that sort of decouples their app side of things from the server. Mm-hmm. So I can do sort of updates on the server, and it's independent of the websites or whatever they're doing with their websites. So I don't know, there's strengths and weaknesses in both approaches, I think. On the Linux side, anyway.
We always say, still using VMs, you still need to back up your data. So things like doing our SQL backups, Exchange backups, we still recommend that. Because if you get some sort of corruption or something, you might not be knowing it, that you've got it until there's an issue. So at least if you've got your backup of your SQL data and stuff, you can then restore it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like I mentioned in last podcast, I'm just coming from the other people look after the hardware.
Yeah.
You know, hosting companies or whatever look after the hardware.
So are you doing things like backup scripts to back up MySQL databases and stuff?
Yeah, I've got there's a quite good utility for Linux called R Snapshot, based on rsync, which I saw in your notes about TerraCopy, actually.
Yeah.
I think it's fairly similar to that, but it's quite clever. You it'll only sync across the data that if you ask it to, from the source to the destination. Mm-hmm. But anyway, R Snapshot uses certain functionality within rsync, and it will back up only the things that have changed. So you can point at a volume, and it will back that up, and then a couple of hours later, it will back up what's changed, and it will present it all in directories.
Yeah.
But the directories will look as if they're full directories, but it's actually doing clever linking back to the original data. So I'm kind of doing that for some clients. And yeah, it's just scripting really, but all over SSH, so it's secure. If they've got two servers, I'll often do a backup, one to the other. Or sometimes they'll have their own server at home or something, or a Linux box at home, which they'll back up to. But I'm thinking of branching out and offering sort of backup services of my own. So
cool.
So yeah, we'll see how that goes.
That TerraCopy thing, I haven't actually used it. I found it the other day. It's kind of like a Windows transfer thing. It's maybe quicker than copying files manually. Apparently, you can do something like pause and resume file transfers. It does error correction. So
yeah, I think I've used it actually on Windows. On my laptop for various things.
I think it does some sort of checking as well, so to make sure like it does some sort of hash or something after it copies across, so there's no corruption or something on it.
Yeah. I mean, rsync will do that on Linux. It's pretty good. You know, you can just point it at destination, and if it's got half the data there and it's failed for some reason, it will just sync it up really nicely. So, and it will do that over SSH as well between two Linux boxes, which is quite nice.
Yeah, that's kind of thing you wanted to talk about, SSH keys, weren't you? You were going to say,
it's something that Linux admins should know. If they don't already know about SSH keys, then they should. When you log into a Linux box on the command line, you'll do it via SSH usually these days, which is good. It means what SSH stands for is Secure Shell. And basically what that means is it encrypts all the traffic between the client, which is in, you know, if you're on a Windows box, PuTTY, or if you're on a Linux box, your terminal, to the SSH server, which is the machine you're logging into. All the traffic that goes between there is encrypted. And there's different ways that you can authenticate when you do that. So people might just be using passwords. Now, passwords can be brute forced, as in, well, if you listen to Security Now, you know exactly what that means. It's someone can just try lots and lots of different passwords until they get the correct one, and then they get in. But using SSH keys, what you do is you generate what's called an asymmetric key pair, and what that means is that you've got two keys, and you've got a private key which you keep and a public key which you can then give to anyone, because if you've got the public key, you can't reverse engineer the private key. That's the idea anyway. I mean, it can be done. It's been found that if you've got enough computing power, some of the older methods of encryption, you can brute force it in the end, but it's a lot harder.
So going back to that then, so you're saying a public and private key, isn't it like you basically could encrypt something with the if you've got something and you encrypt it with the private key,
you encrypt it with your private key, and anyone with the public key can decrypt it. So it's called public key cryptography. There is a, I really should have looked this up, but there is a kind of easy way of explaining it that's quite easy to understand.
Doesn't mean if someone's got a public key and they encrypt it with that public key, the only person who can decrypt it is the private key. Is that correct?
So I think it's the other way around. I think if you've got a public key, if you encrypt it with a public key, then anyone can read it. But because it's used as a way of proving that you are who you say you are in that case, because everyone's got your public key, and this thing is encrypted with your public key. So if it's like using email, PGP, I think. So if you send an email with a public key, anyone can decrypt it, but they know it came from you. So if that's important to you, you can prove it that way. But
yeah, because I've never really understood. I'm guessing I should, because we recorded a HBR episode, didn't we? Our experience at LogCamp, and when I was emailing in the show to say I wanted to upload, the guy had encrypted the or he put a PGP key on the email to and I'm guessing that it's just, I obviously haven't got encryption set up on my email, so obviously I just got the email with his key. But does that just mean that it just proves that he sent it. If that...
Yeah, yeah, because the idea is that your key is your key and no one else has your key. You know, mathematically speaking, it's impossible for anyone else to have that key, yeah, sort of thing. So I think that's the idea.
Okay.
I really need to do a bit more research on all of this cryptography stuff.
No,
I do listen to Steve Gibson, but sometimes it goes in one ear.
I have to do a lot of work with CA servers, which is like, it's like, you know, when you get your certificate and you get to go to the green bar on the website. Well, you can run that inside your own company with Windows 2000 and 8 or whatever and above, or you can do it 2003, 2000. So you can run your own certificate servers inside. So you can you can do things like you can generate certificates. You know, if you like go to, if you, I don't know if you get like a, I do, like you, if you have an appliance at work or something in it, or it's got like a self-signed certificate, and it's got, and you go to it and it's got the red text going, warning, this is not a trusted certificate. Yeah. Well, we do things... Yeah. I do a lot of that where you create your own CA and you can create your own certificates. And you, once you create your own certificate and everyone's got that root certificate in their machines, you can then put that into that device, and then you'll get when you go to that device next, you get the nice green tick, the green padlock and not the red. And I always get really confused because if I don't do it for a couple of weeks or months, I have to go back and read my book to understand about things like.
I mean, SSL is another area. I mean, I hope none of my clients are listening to this. I don't fully understand it, but it's similar to SSH from what I understand.
Yeah, it's key pairing, isn't it? I think it's called.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing that confuses me is the whole certificate signing thing. I don't really understand that step, because with SSH, it's quite simple. You just generate a public key and a private key, and that's all you have to do. And you just put the public key on the server that you want to log into. Yeah. The private key is on your machine, and when you do the SSH, when you initiate the SSH session, it talks. They know how to talk to each other, and it finds the key, and lets you log in. Everything's fine and dandy.
Yeah.
And you can even. I mean, I use it an SSH agent. So you put your private key into this agent. And often you will lock your private key with a passphrase or passkey, and you only have to put that in once. So you can actually log into any server without a password, as long as you've got your private key in your agent running. And it's a hell of a lot easier. You don't have to remember any passwords. So all you have to worry about is keeping your private key safe.
Yeah, the other thing is, as well, is... you can do things like, if you want to transfer files between two machines, it's a bit risky because you could put in your script the password, couldn't you, for the username and password?
Yeah.
But obviously, if you can put that that key, can't you? If you
What you can do is you can generate a key pair without a passphrase. So when your script runs, it just uses key authentication and it doesn't need a password. Doesn't sound that secure to me, but at least the data is encrypted as it goes between as it goes over the internet. So
yeah, because I use that to a couple of machines to back stuff up, kind of thing, so that every day it uses those keys, does the SSH thing, and does the R sync over the SSH.
So
the only thing that worried about me is that somewhere it can compromises your server or something, they then get your keys and they can then do quite nasty stuff. But I'm guessing it's a lot more secure than having someone brute forcing your password. I'm guessing this.
Well, if you haven't got password authentication turned on your server, then it's a lot less likely to be compromised.
Yeah.
So that's a good reason to use keys. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it.
Yeah. So going back to that PDP thing, does that actually sign the emails that say the site, so you know it's? Because I think they have a thing. I listened to another Hacker Republic raise where you go to different places and people prove who you are, don't they? Because anyone could pretend to be me or you or whatever, and then...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't... Again, I never use PGP, really. So I'm only just getting... Well...
I don't know if it just secures the email between the two, because I'm just wondering... I'm not really paranoid. People can read my email. I don't have much going through my email. People want to know what I'm doing or whatever, or... Just emailing myself with Kate, my wife, a shopping list or something, then who cares if it reads it? Well, I'm not putting anything in my email. Yeah. I don't want anybody else to know, kind of thing. So,
I think there's various things you can do with email, but again, more research needed there, I think. Yeah. I think you can send an encrypted email, but it parts of it must need to be unencrypted so that the mail server knows, because the mail server reads the headers and the email.
Yeah.
So that bit at least would have to be unencrypted for it to do its thing. So, yeah, more research needed. More detail in the future episode, listeners.
So, have you heard a thing called WSUS before, Ant?
I have actually. I came across it in an old day job.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the Linux boxes that that company I was working for was putting into these places was screwing it up. So it's an update server, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, so you know, like if you've got your machines on the network, they will go out. So if you've got 10 machines, they will go out to the internet to get updates. They're obviously pulling all the updates down. Each machine is downloading it from Windows Update. With WSUS is where you can have a server which basically goes out to the internet and downloads the updates for you. And then you can go into that server and you can say auto approve updates, or you can tell it to... you can auto approve updates. So every time an update comes in, you can auto approve it, and then it can be released again. Or you go in there manually. That's what I like to do. I normally like to leave my updates at least 2 weeks after they come out, because there's been a couple of instances in the last couple of weeks where you got a load of blue screens and stuff and breaking stuff. So I like to just, when you go out, when all the updates come down, it will say these computers need these 8 updates, and you can go and look at the knowledge bases. I just do a quick Google on the knowledge base and see if anyone's come up with any issues with implying those updates. So what you do is you basically just run it on IIS on a certain port. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, but you install it on your on the servers. It's free, and it basically just downloads it. You can then, interestingly, you basically, we're using group policy, which is a way of, I don't know if you want group, have you heard of group policy there before?
Yeah.
So it's a way of basically putting out settings to your PC. So if you're on a domain, you can tell different things of the computer what to do. And we can basically tell that Windows Update, you can tell it to either get its Windows updates from the internet, or if you get it from your WSUS, you basically say what you point it to the server. And you can then also tell it when you want the updates to be applied. So you can say things like download the updates from the server, and then tell the user can then choose from what time to install it. Or you can say automatically install it at 3 o'clock in the morning. Or you can, or things like that, if you see what I mean.
So is that on the client? The client pulls it down from the server?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So that's... So I had a bit of work the day that one of the WSUS servers was broken, and I fixed it. And then the group policy said that install updates, but don't restart, let the system administrator install it. And it was odd that these servers just started randomly rebooting. And I was going, why is it rebooting? Because the setting says don't reboot, this administrator. So what you can do is you can log on to the server and look in the event view, and it will tell you what's been happening. And I looked through it, and it says downloading update, waiting for the administrator to install. This is a bit odd. Then it says, Windows 2008, Service Pack 1 restarted this server. And I'm going, why is Service Pack 1 restarting this server? And I looked front. You can look further into the log files for this. The WSUS client on the machine, which is basically the Windows Update client, I'll put a link in the show notes where that is. And you can go in there and you can look at this text file, and it will tell you what it's doing. And it's saying downloading these updates. And it says deadline update installing now. Well, what the hell's a deadline update? And what someone has done is before is that you can set a deadline on an update, and they've done it, and you put a date when it's got to be installed by. And if it isn't installed by that date, next time past that date, it will automatically install that update and reboot the server, and it will ignore whatever settings in group policy. So if anyone comes across that, you should, yeah, have a look at this deadline issue. It's probably good if you want to, if you've got like a 0-day update comes out and you need to get it out to all your customers, your clients, servers and everything. But it's this deadline issue which is causing me why the servers would reboot.
Well, I guess if it's a, like you say, if it's a 0-day, it has to be.
Yeah, but this one is a service pack for Windows 2008 R2. So I don't know why everyone had, but someone obviously gone in there at some point and said this server needs to all have a service pack 1 installed. So
I guess it just comes. It must have been some flag in the service pack saying reboot me now.
Yeah, well, it wasn't that. You can basically, when you approve an update, it says you can improve it, but then there's this option you can say deadline. And you can say, I want this update installed by so-and-so date. And that date had passed, so everyone was forced to have this update. So, yeah.
Okay.
If anyone has a random thing of updates, appliance and computer and rebooting, when you know that the settings tell you that where it is, that it, sorry, updating it as randomly reboots, and you know, have a look at that client thing, and then you can... see where it is. There's also an interesting about how do you know what update server you're using. So if you haven't got access to look at the group policy just to see what these are, you actually a thing in the registry where you can go to and it will tell you what the where the updates are coming from, what server, if it's coming from a WSUS server or a Windows update server, and it'll also tell you if it's what the settings are like, when new updates will be installed or etc., that kind of thing. So
yeah, I've done a fair amount of registry hacking in my my Windows days. So, yeah,
another
nice thing about Linux is that everything is in text files, so it's kind of a little bit easier to look at, and you don't feel quite as I always felt a bit dodgy going into the registry.
Well, you could do damage so much by making one mistake kind of thing.
So yeah.
I did know an
interesting... I mean, you can do some pretty bad stuff with if you get the wrong text file, but it's it tends to be a bit more compartmentalised and so on in Linux.
Another issue I came across this thing is this Seaport program, which Martin was mentioning on the Geeksters the other day. I had to work out if a program was installed and listening on a certain port. It's like a bit like the netstat command where you run.
Yeah.
You can run on Windows. You can run it on Linux as well, can't you? And this basically matches what the port is to what program or what process is running that program.
Yeah.
That port.
Yeah, you can do that with netstat fairly easily. On Linux. I don't know if you can do it on Windows.
Yeah, you can do, but it's a bit of work. If you just run a little 64K application, it shows you really well. So.
Okay. Yeah, it's on Linux. If you do netstat, I always remember it as pant. It's PANT, which is protocol TCP or UDP. A for all, N for don't resolve the host names, and T for TCP/IP. If you want to have UDP in there as well, put a U on the end. I guess we'll put that in the show notes because text doesn't come across that well on audio.
No,
probably.
So. If there's any kind of Reddit fans out there, I found out there's one the other day called Tales from the Tech Support, where people just put stories, what they've got from work on there, which is quite an interesting read at some point.
I always read things like that. It's always interesting to see what other people have come across, in case it bites you as
well.
So.
It's interesting. Good. Okay, well... we had an email, haven't we, as well, Liz?
Oh, yeah, I see it here. Okay, here we go. Hey, guys. New listener here. Great show. I recently listened to Admin Podcast 007,
ooh,
a chat with another Al. Well, secret agent Al.
Yeah.
The other Al. and had a few questions about Office 365. Number one, how would you go about selling Office 365 to your clients? Is it worth it? Do you need to be of a certain MS partner level? What are the requirements for selling Office 365?
Shall I answer those ones first then, and then we go on?
Should we go one at a time? It's got three questions.
Yeah.
go one at a time.
How would you go about selling Office 365? Is it worth it? Yes, it is. I think it is, because it takes a lot of burden off them having to look after Exchange internally. It is so cheap to run, and it takes the hassle of looking after it for your customer. It's not down to you kind of thing. And I think the customers get a better experience because they get a lot more bang for their buck, and they always be running the latest software. The problem is a kickback. You don't get that back, great kickback from Microsoft for it, because we're a gold partner at work with it, and I don't know what the kickback is, but you have to have a certain level amount of money before you get it back, if you see what I mean. So you have to have a number of clients to get the money back. But I think you can. What we do is we sell us Office 365, but then we sell a support contract on top of that, so that we look after it for the customer, because the customer has no idea how to go in and add a user, or if something goes wrong, they have no idea how to speak to Microsoft. So we kind of bundle it in. And for our smaller customers, they go directly to Office 365 and they buy it directly through Office 365. And then you haven't got to worry about that thing, is that the customer doesn't pay you, but Microsoft is still going to ask you for the money for it. So like if you're reselling it, actually what happens is when you're a partner, you sign them up for it, but they pay directly to Microsoft. But some people, I'm guessing, will probably want it so that they pay you for the money and then you can then put a percentage on it. But I would say definitely buy it directly from Microsoft and then kind of do some sort of support agreement with them so that you look after it for them, so that, I don't know how much you want to charge, but I think that's a good way of selling it, because you're providing a service. So if something goes wrong, they can come to you and say, look, I've got a problem with this. They haven't got to go speak to Microsoft with it. You can fix it. Or if there's something you don't know how to fix it, you can go off and fix it for them, kind of thing. So
yeah, I guess that, because, I mean, looking at that, you think, hang on, are Microsoft cutting out the middleman here and just selling sort of directly to the client? But yeah, you sort of make the money on support. And interestingly, that's the way that kind of open source companies operate, or open source software. That's how people generally have made money out of it over the years, is because it's generally, it can be quite hard to use, so you sell support for it, and you know, so you as an IT professional,
yeah,
can sort of take a bit of money that way, if you know. So yeah, it's good. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, as well. I know Microsoft probably put everything in the cloud and stuff, but someone's still got to support it. Someone's still got to be on the ground running, doing all the bits behind it.
Yeah,
I don't think we
have answering the phones.
Yeah, we haven't got. We aren't going to be out of a job soon. So
no, that's good. Okay, question number two. With Office 365, can you add a second domain as an alias for Exchange? Does this cost additional? How would you go about configuring this?
All right. So he's saying you've got companyabc.com as your primary email address and configured in Office 365, but you also got companyabc.co.uk. If I wanted to add that in, would it cost anything extra? No, it doesn't cost anything extra. There's an option. When you set up Office 365, you have to prove that you own a domain. It's, you go through a thing like you have, I can't remember off the top of my head what you have to do, but you have to like put something like, sent an email, you have to click a link, or you have to put some certain DNS record in and it will go off and find it. So all you do is you go into your Office 365 portal, go to your domain name section, and you can add a second domain in, and you click add it in, and it will say verify this domain. You verify that domain, and once you've got the verified domain, you can then add that email. You can then add that email address. You can start adding you can start using that domain in your email address. Things like, so like you do in an Exchange, you can add more than one domain into Exchange server recipient list. Right. You can add this. It does it all for you.
Right.
And then one more.
Okay. Question number three. Then with Office 365, can you add a second email address as an alias for a user? Does this cost additional? How would you go about configuring this?
So I'm guessing he's saying that can you add aliases or whatever, so you could have Owl at companyabc.com, and then you can I have Alistair at companyabc.com? Yes, you can. exactly the same way you do it, kind of thing, like Office 365. In Exchange, you can go in there and add that second alias, and you just go into Office 365, click on the user, go to his email address page, and then you can just add in the second email address. Once you configured that domain into Office 365, you can then add it in. So,
how would if you've got different domains? So, you had our at company.abc.com and our at company.abc.co.uk.
Yeah.
Could you do that as well?
Yes.
Okay.
And then you can just set whatever one you want as your primary one, as that'll be the one it gets sent from. So.
Okay.
Cool.
Cool. That's okay. And he signs off saying, "Thanks, guys. Off to catch up with more of your podcasts."
Yeah,
I'm going to do that as well, because I haven't listened to the early ones yet, despite being on the podcast.
They might be a bit ropey, but there you go. We're getting better, hopefully. So it's good to get an email.
More professional.
It was good to get an email in. So anybody out there wants to email us, you can get emails at mail@abnabnpodcast.co.uk. I do like emails. I received that this morning. So, I do like to get an email. At least that knows that someone's actually listening to us and we're not speaking to...
Yeah, into the void.
Yeah.
Need a bit of reverb for that. Where's the effect?
So have you got anything else to mention tonight there?
I was just going to talk a bit more about fail to ban. It might have been a bit garbled earlier at the start of the podcast. But it's a neat little package, open source, free, available for most Linux distributions.
Yeah. I was going to say, I guess you can't get it for Windows, I'm guessing.
Don't think so, no, but maybe there's an opening there for someone to write a similar thing. It will basically, you point at a log file and you set it looking for a log file or log files, and you set it looking for a regular expression, and it comes, by default, it looks at your auth.log or your secure if you're on CentOS, and what you see most of in there, if you've got a server open to the internet, is people trying to log into your SSH. Mm-hmm. And there's various things that fail, hence the name, I guess, messages you get in the log when it fails, and it will check the log every certain amount of time, every minute or something, I think. And it will look for these messages and look for the IPs associated with those messages, and it will ban them for a given length of time. And so your auth log goes from, hundreds of these failed login messages to none, which is really nice. And generally, the scripts that are doing these, attempting these logins will go and look somewhere else. So it's a good, nice, simple defense against people attacking your ports that are open to the internet. Like I was saying earlier, a denial of service attack going on one of my client servers. I found the sort of offending thing in the logs. With Apache, you've got an error, an access log and an error log. So I saw that there was something going on in the error log, but there was nothing that I could sort of look for to ban a regular expression or anything. So looking in the access log, I noticed a couple of times a second I was getting the same message again and again and again, and it's pretty obvious that that was what was causing the problem with the server. So I had a rule already that I'd got off the internet somewhere, and I adapted that for this particular attack, and all it's doing is it's trying to access a certain file in WordPress in this case, mm-hmm. but it could be any file. Put in that regular expression, and 30 seconds later, the denial of a service attack was pretty much over, because the IPs that were doing it had been banned. That's, by the way, that's done with the IP tables built-in firewall mm-hmm. in Linux. Again, something I've never got my head around, but fail to ban will just put in a nice firewall rule to ban those IPs on that port, which means you don't have to, or I don't have to. So it's really nice little package, and good hopefully my client was duly impressed. I didn't get any feedback actually, so I might as well just not have done it. But there we go.
So does it clear those IP addresses out ever again, or do you have does it manually?
Well, by default, it bans them for 10 minutes, I think, or 15 minutes or something like that, and then it'll let them back again. But often by that time, they've gone on to someone else. And if they do that in the next 5 minutes, they'll just get banned again. Okay. So, I mean, mostly denial of service, what they do is they use up your server's resources, so it can't serve web pages anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if it's not doing that, then your server's happy. You can actually, because fail to ban itself has a log, and then you can look through that log for sort of serial offenders and ban them for a longer time if you want to. It's all very configurable.
Cool. Okay, well, I think we've come up to about an hour now. So, anything else to say there? I could go on to Andy. I'm really terrible with names when I first meet people or start talking to them.
Is that Andy Mark too?
Yeah.
That's pretty much all I wanted to say. Brag about my fail to ban exploits again and to the world at large. But no, that's it for me, I think.
Good. All right. Well, if you want to get hold of us, you can email us at mail@adminpodcast.co.uk. We were talking about competition. I wanted to wait until Andy's back before we mention it. So we'll mention it next time. So thanks for listening, guys, and we'll hear from you soon.